You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hello, everyone. My name is Wesley Livesay from the History of the Second World War podcast. Join me on a journey through the most destructive conflict in human history, a journey that will take us not just through the famous campaigns and cataclysmic battles, but also to the lesser well-known corners of the war that touched millions all over the world, as we try and answer not just the questions of what and where, but how and why. You can find History of the Second World War on all major podcast platforms or at historyofthesecondworldwar.com.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 113, Victory or Death. Thanks for joining me. Before we get started, I'd like to thank those of you who have contributed financially. Without your help, the show would not be sustainable. There's nothing in the world I'd rather be doing, so thank you for giving me the opportunity to keep doing it. As you know, patrons also get access to special bonus content, The Dispatches. The last installment included a discussion of one of the most unusual units in the Napoleonic French army, the Mamluks of the Imperial Guard. We also delved into a few unsolved mysteries from this era of history. These bonus episodes have been a lot of fun. I hope you'll consider joining us. Visit patreon.com/ageofnapoleon to sign up. Anyway, we left off last time in the spring of 1808. Napoleon had invited the Spanish royal family to the city of Bayonne, where he had strong-armed them into repudiating their claims to the throne. The emperor gave the Spanish crown to his older brother, Joseph, and imposed a written French-style constitution on the country. The upper ranks of the Spanish nobility had been summoned to Bayonne to give their assent to these momentous changes. Few of them agreed with Bonaparte's actions, but almost all had complied. However, as Napoleon tightened his grip on the Spanish government, the Spanish people seemed increasingly determined to slip out of his grasp. On the 2nd of May, the people of Madrid rose up in a doomed, defiant rebellion against the French occupiers. Although the insurgents were defeated relatively easily, the fighting had been extremely intense. And this was not an isolated incident. All over the country, there had been violent confrontations between French soldiers and Spanish civilians, and sporadic acts of protest and resistance. There was a strong and growing spirit of defiance within Spain, but as of yet, no leadership had stepped forward to organize and channel these feelings. Last episode, I left you with the scene of Joseph Bonaparte on his way to Madrid, reporting back to Napoleon that none of his new subjects turned out to greet him as he passed through their villages and towns. Joseph was deeply pessimistic about this new venture. His letters to his brother from this period are full of doom and gloom. Quote, "You are making a mistake, sire. Your glory will not be enough to subjugate Spain. I will fail, and the limits of your power will be exposed." End quote. Joseph would arrive at his new capital without incident. But by this point, the French position in Spain was deteriorating so quickly that he would only spend 9 days in the city before being forced to flee. That's quite a dramatic change. If you'll recall last episode, only a few weeks earlier, Napoleon was telling his senior advisors Spain was as good as conquered. But soon, he wouldn't even be able to guarantee his own brother's safety in his palace in the capital. In this episode, we'll explore how that happened. How Spain found its footing, began the difficult task of organizing the country for resistance, and gained the confidence to challenge Napoleon's forces on the battlefield. We've seen how the tension had been slowly ratcheting up ever since French forces began occupying the country. That process continued throughout this period. News of the massacres in Madrid on the 2nd and 3rd of May spread throughout the country, provoking protests in many cities and towns, some of which turned violent. There was nothing quite on the same scale as the events of the Dos de Mayo, but it was clear that the sentiments that had moved the people of Madrid to rise up were not unique to the capital. In the space of a week, three pro-French provincial governors were assassinated by their own constituents. Clearly, things were spinning out of control. The central government was now totally under French control, and even average people increasingly saw it as nothing more than a tool of the hated occupiers. No surprise, its authority was no longer respected. The country was in the midst of its worst crisis in centuries, and was, in many ways, effectively without a government. Of course, there were people invested with authority all over Spain. Local government officials mostly stayed at their posts, trying to do their jobs as best they could. There was the Catholic clergy, which maintained its own hierarchical structure and was intertwined with almost every facet of Spanish life. Military officers had no formal authority in civilian politics, but as in most societies, they were generally respected. And with the situation in the country turning increasingly violent, people did look to the military for leadership. And as we've discussed many times in past episodes, the Spanish aristocracy was quite powerful. From the senior nobles at court down to minor landholders, nobility really meant something in Spain. So there wasn't any shortage of authority figures in the country. The main structure of authority, the central government, had lost almost all of its prestige and legitimacy, but the foundations of that structure remained as solid as ever. And so, without any direction from above or any single unifying figure, these disparate local authorities began reconstituting government structures on their own initiative. These local provisional governments were referred to as juntas. That word has a specific connotation in English. It is used exclusively to refer to authoritarian military regimes. It is a loan word from Spanish, but it is actually a shortening of a specific Spanish phrase, junta militar, or military junta. As that phrase implies, the word junta is much more generic in Spanish. It can refer to any kind of governing committee, democratic, authoritarian, or in between, and civilian or military. Even today, the local governments of many Spanish regions are referred to as juntas, even though they are elected and composed entirely of civilians. In this case, they were not elected. The juntas of 1808 organized themselves and formed their membership based on consensus. In a typical junta, you would find a cross-section of prominent local residents. The backbone was often the pre-invasion local government, minus any officials who were seen as pro-French. They were usually joined by senior local clergymen, eminent members of the nobility, and leaders of military units stationed in the area. Today, we might call these types of people pillars of the community. Back in Napoleonic times, the stock phrase was usually local notables. The mix was different in every junta. In one place, you might find civilian politicians and bureaucrats in the majority. In another, it might be military officers. And in another, the church might dominate. We can't generalize too much about politics or ideology. The first organizers of the juntas were mostly Fernandistas, supporters of King Ferdinand. But the Fernandistas were not an ideologically united bloc, and they would soon be joined by others from almost the entire political spectrum. It probably goes without saying there were no left-wing radicals. You simply didn't find such people among the upper ranks of Spanish society, and the rare exceptions would not have been welcome. The leadership of the Catholic clergy were prominent in the committees, and they were almost uniformly right-wing, often outright reactionaries, many of whom believed the absolutist Bourbon monarchs of the 18th century had actually gone too far. Major landowners were also heavily represented, and many of them felt the same way. On the other hand, you could find plenty of prominent liberals as well. The Count of Florida Blanca, who had been prime minister before Godoy and was generally seen as the leader of the liberal faction at court, became a major figure in the movement, as did Gaspar Melchor de Jovellanos, probably the greatest living Spanish Enlightenment thinker. And many members were more or less non-ideological. They simply saw the need to fill the vacuum of authority, detested the occupation, and were ready to do their duty. At first, the juntas were a purely local phenomenon. They formed in a city or town and worked to manage the affairs in their immediate surroundings. But with time, they formed links between one another, and hierarchies began to emerge. Juntas in smaller cities subordinated themselves to bigger, more effective, and better-funded juntas in the nearest big city, who in turn typically deferred to the authority of the junta in the provincial capital. As we've discussed in past episodes, Spain had never had a very strong central government. It had always been a country of semi-autonomous provinces, going back centuries. Regional identities were strong. Given this history, the juntas in the traditional provincial capitals saw it as quite natural to extend their authority over the entire province, and local juntas generally saw it as quite natural to accept this. As is always the case in politics, theory was rarely borne out in practice. Juntas often squabbled with one another. There were many cases in which junior committees flouted the authority of more senior committees, or even refused to recognize them altogether. There were even cases of rival juntas trying to arrest or attack each other. These were provisional committees, operating without any kind of clear written constitution, figuring things out as they went along. It was rarely a smooth process. But despite these problems, the rise of the juntas rapidly transformed the Spanish political scene, at the very time that Napoleon was closing his grip around the central government, an alternative source of authority was emerging. Almost every junta claimed they were merely acting in the name of the people. To a certain extent, that was true. As we've seen in recent episodes, there was massive public anger at the occupation, and at the government's failure to challenge the French. The juntas were organized, at least in part, to respond to that anger. But I think it's a bit of a stretch to call this a grassroots movement. The members were, almost by definition, the most eminent and powerful people in any given place in Spain. Indeed, in many cases, they were actually motivated to act out of fear of the public. As anti-French feelings grew, protests and public disturbances and even riots became more common all over the country. In almost any era, in almost any context, the upper classes and the authorities are opposed to public unrest and political violence. Even if they agree with the cause, they have an overriding interest in keeping things orderly and running smoothly. Many members of the juntas joined, at least in part, out of a desire to keep a lid on popular unrest, or at least channel it into more useful, productive purposes. In the city of Valencia, a Franciscan friar begged a menacing anti-French crowd to listen to reason. He put it this way, quote, "Gentlemen, the public is a monster unless it permits itself to be governed by one person, whom all the rest obey. Without that, everything will be disorder and confusion. Remember, we shall not defeat the French with clamors and shouts, but only with weapons and armies and a good government to lead us. And, at the present, we are lacking all of these. If we know how to conduct ourselves, we will triumph." End quote. This speech had the desired effect. The crowd settled down, nominated that friar to be their leader, and he took their demands to the local government. All over Spain, many average people were receptive to these arguments. The juntas were met with a huge groundswell of popular support. A lot of people were angry at the French, and at the central government. But now that an alternative to that government was finally emerging, they were willing to put aside their anger and put their energies into working for victory. Last episode, we saw the people of Madrid congregate around government arsenals and military barracks, asking the officials in charge to open the armories and distribute weapons. You see this pattern in many of the popular protests of that period, people begging their local authorities to do something about the French, or failing that, to at least help facilitate some kind of popular action against the occupation. The juntas were an answer to those pleas, a group of respected, more or less legitimate authorities who were willing to do their part in the struggle against the occupation. In the spring of 1808, the emerging provincial juntas began mobilizing Spanish military units in their territory, calling up militias, organizing them into armies, and putting out the call for volunteers. Some actually went so far as to issue declarations of war against France. Others stopped short of open confrontation for the moment, but went to work putting their provinces on a war footing. The declaration from one junta went like this, quote, "To arms, to arms, victory or death. Is it not better to die, arms in hand, on the field of honor, defending our unhappy monarch, our homes, our children, and our wives, than to die a vile and ignominious slave's death? Do you want fetters on your feet and manacles on your hands? Let us invoke the God of armies, for our cause is just, and God will lead us and support us. We fight in defense of religion, the fatherland, our laws, and our country. A people resolute and united are never defeated. Landowners, merchants, and the wealthy, show your generosity by contributing liberally to the homeland's common needs. War is a lesser evil than peace, for only this terrible means can save us." End quote. All over the country, average Spaniards answered the call. By late spring, there were tens of thousands of fresh recruits being trained up in dozens of new regiments. It's quite impressive for a country half under occupation, without any real national government. But this new Spanish army would have a lot of limitations. There was barely any time for training. As we'll see in a moment, circumstances would force many of these units into action only weeks or even days after their formation. Some men would effectively not be trained at all, only given a musket and told to learn on the job. Most of the officers were no better trained or experienced than the men they were expected to lead. As we've discussed in past episodes, Spain lagged behind the great powers in modern reforms that applied to the army as well as the government. There was no system of modern military academies in Spain, like the one that had produced Napoleon and many of his top generals. The Spanish army was still mostly on that old, early modern system. Young boys joined the military as officer cadets and were mentored in the art of command by the older officers in their regiment, often including a father, uncle, or cousin. Under ideal conditions, this system could produce good officers. But these were not ideal conditions. Spain needed officers who could be ready to lead in weeks or even days, not years. And with the army expanding so rapidly, there often was no wiser, experienced officer to show the new men the ropes. The male literacy rate in Spain was somewhere around 15%. To put that in perspective, in France, it was probably over 50%, and in Britain, over 60%. In some cases, choosing officers and sergeants and corporals for these new units was as simple as, "Can any of you read? Okay, you're in charge." Spain was a poor country, with very little domestic manufacturing. Equipping these units to even a basic standard would probably have been impossible under the best of conditions. With half the country occupied by the French, and the entire enterprise being organized by a loose network of improvised provisional governments, it was even harder. As you just heard in that proclamation, the juntas were actually reduced to begging wealthy people for charity, which should give you some sense of how few resources they had to work with. It was impossible for the Patriots to get their hands on the numbers of trained war horses they would need to form cavalry units. Cannons were almost as hard to come by and much more expensive, so artillery was out too. Almost every single one of these new units would be infantry. As we've discussed in past episodes, in a proper Napoleonic era army, the three branches of the service worked in harmony, compensating for each other's weaknesses and amplifying each other's strengths. That would not be possible with an army composed almost entirely of infantry. With all that said, these fresh volunteers would not be going into battle alone. The old Spanish royal army was technically under the authority of the central government, now ruled by Joseph Bonaparte. However, as you might imagine, very few of their number were eager to serve the new king. Many units simply swore allegiance to the nearest junta and joined in the preparations for war. It was a bit more complicated for regiments stationed in cities occupied by the French. In many cases, they were sent out to arrest some nearby junta or put down a local rebellion, then switched sides once they arrived at their objective. There were a few cases in which the senior officers wanted to stay true to the central government and King Joseph, and were arrested by their subordinates, who then led the regiment in defecting to the Patriot side. The trained professionals of the Royal Army were definitely a cut above the raw volunteers, but as you might remember from past episodes, the Spanish army was not well regarded by the other European powers. That poor reputation had more or less been borne out in the last round of fighting between France and Spain in the 1790s. The quality of Spanish regular army units was very uneven. As you might remember from our early episodes on the pre-revolutionary French military, in this type of old-fashioned, old-regime army, each regiment was practically the personal property of its colonel, and each had its own deeply ingrained internal culture. There was little uniformity in training, tactics, or even daily life. And remember, new officers were generally not trained by any national military academy with a standard curriculum, but by their superiors within the regiment. So leadership and officer training varied quite a bit as well. Many officers were ignorant of modern military theory, unless they took the initiative to seek it out and read it themselves. Some units were well-run with well-trained men and capable officers. Some were not. Like many European countries, Spain also had a militia system. In fact, in typical Spanish fashion, the country actually had a whole host of different militia systems, which varied province by province. As we'll see later in the episode, some Spanish provinces actually had more than one type of militia. However, like militias we've discussed in the past, they were generally poorly trained, poorly equipped, and not very reliable. Although, as we'll see, they certainly had their uses. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply. The fact that Spain was able to scrape together tens of thousands of troops in a short time under these difficult circumstances is frankly pretty amazing. It took real courage to volunteer for this fight, joining an army destitute of everything, without even a real government to back it up. And just think of who they were opposing. Napoleon's army, one of the greatest in history. In the past decade and a half, French armies had laid low the Prussians, the Austrians, the Russians, and the British, in some cases more than once. It had been nearly a decade since any significant French unit had suffered a defeat on the battlefield. All of Europe was at Napoleon's feet. Many Spanish patriots believed God was on their side, and they would surely need his help to defeat this seemingly invincible enemy. However, when you look closely at the French forces in Spain, the task facing the Patriots doesn't look quite so daunting. With a few exceptions, Napoleon had not sent his best troops into Spain. Most of the Imperial Guard was in Madrid with Marshal Murat, because they always made a big impression wherever they went. But there were only a few thousand of them, and they were the only significant body of well-trained, experienced French troops in the entire country. The cream of the Grande Armée was back in France, or still in Germany. Most of the occupation force was composed of second-line troops, units that were organized and equipped to roughly the same standard as the rest of the military, but inexperienced, not as well-trained, or not as reliable. Units fit for garrison duty, coastal patrols, or guarding supply trains, but not the types of troops you would want to rely on in a battle. As we've discussed in past episodes, by this point in the Napoleonic Wars, referring to Napoleon's forces as French is often more of a convenient shorthand than a literal description of where the men actually came from. Many were Italian, Polish, German, Swiss, or Dutch. That was particularly true in Spain in the spring of 1808. In some of the engagements we'll be talking about later in this episode, the only French combatants were a small handful of senior officers. Napoleon's foreign troops ran the gamut. Some were actually elite units who performed better than the average comparable French unit, like the famous Red Lancers of the Imperial Guard, who were mostly Dutch. Many others were not elite, but simply solid, and comparable to the line regiments of the Grande Armée. For instance, the Army of the Grand Duchy of Warsaw had a reputation for turning out units that were equal to their French peers. However, there were also many foreign units that fell short of the Grande Armée's high standards. They tended to have lower morale, be less motivated, less disciplined, and less trained. Napoleon preferred not to use them in battle, and so they lacked combat experience. The vast majority of the foreign units in Spain fell into this latter category. Their main use to Napoleon was that they could free up more effective French troops for more important missions. As for the units composed of actual Frenchmen, other than the Imperial Guard, they were all freshly raised regiments. Hardly any of them had ever fired their muskets in anger. None had seen a major battle. Their officers were not the best of the best either. Think of some of the names you've come to know over the course of this show. Davout, Ney, Augereau, Masséna, Soult, Lannes. None of them were in Spain. Napoleon himself wasn't either. The only real big name who would see action in this chapter of the story was the commander of the Imperial Guard, Marshal Jean-Baptiste Bessières, and Bessières was not particularly well regarded by his peers. Marshal Marmont famously said that if Bessières could become a marshal, anyone could. It was widely believed that Bessières earned his blue baton through his almost fanatical loyalty to Napoleon, not through his skill as a commander. The French leadership we'll be talking about in the next few episodes were quite competent. They had been forged on the same hard crucible that had produced those great generals we just mentioned. As we've discussed many times in past episodes, the French army had almost universally good leadership, probably the best in the world. But most of the senior French commanders in Spain in the spring and summer of 1808 were not at the top tier of the French officer corps, and as we'll see, they made some questionable decisions. So to make a long story short, the French army in Spain was not the army of Austerlitz or Jena or Friedland. But there were certainly a lot of them, roughly 100,000 in total. However, the only real major concentration of French forces was in Madrid with Marshal Murat. The majority were scattered across the country in groups of no more than a few thousand. Although they were not scattered across the entire country. As we've discussed in past episodes, the invasion of Spain was to be carried out gradually, in stages. At this stage, French troops were only present in about half the country, mostly in large cities, and mostly in the north, east, and center. The south and west were largely unoccupied, and there were areas technically under occupation where you might find huge swaths of territory, hundreds of miles wide, without a single French soldier. 100,000 men sounds like a lot, and if they were all concentrated together in a single army, that would be a lot. But when you start parceling them out over hundreds of miles of territory populated by millions of people, it doesn't take long before that huge number starts to seem like a drop in a very big bucket. In short, despite armed conflict obviously looming on the horizon, the French forces in Spain were not in top form. Their commander-in-chief wasn't either. In Madrid, Marshal Murat had taken ill. At least, that was the official story. He locked himself in his chambers, refusing to see anyone. When he was finally convinced to allow a doctor to make an examination, the diagnosis was exhaustion from overwork. Just as it is today, this was often a euphemism, usually for what we would call mental health problems. A French diplomat in Madrid wrote to the emperor, asking him to send Murat a letter of support. It was well known that Napoleon's friendship meant everything to Murat. As you might recall from last episode, Murat and his wife, Caroline Bonaparte, had been lobbying Napoleon to appoint the flamboyant cavalryman King of Spain. Not only had the emperor shot them down, in typical Napoleonic fashion, he hadn't been very polite in doing so. Murat had always been desperate for Napoleon's approval, and the combination of his disappointment at being passed over and a rude rejection by his idol and closest friend seems to have triggered some kind of mental health crisis. This panic attack or bout of depression or whatever it was dragged on for 2 weeks. Finally, Murat wrote to Napoleon asking to be replaced, so he could return to France to convalesce at the spa town of Barège. Bonaparte agreed. Murat's replacement would be General Anne Jean-Marie René Savary. He was a capable man, not only an experienced military commander, but a diplomat, intelligence officer, and politician. However, Savary had never commanded a unit bigger than a division in combat, and his reputation within the army and among his fellow officers was nowhere approaching that of Marshal Murat. Murat's breakdown could not have come at a worse time. As you've heard, the French position in Spain was getting more and more precarious. Every day the juntas were growing stronger and more organized. More men flocked to join the Patriot Army units forming all over the country, and more of the old Royal Army defected. War was clearly coming, the signs were everywhere, but at this crucial moment, the leader of all French forces in Spain was locked in his bedroom alone, rather than busy with his staff preparing his forces to fight. The fuse had been lit on the 2nd of May. Everyone was just waiting for the explosions to begin. The first blast would come on the 6th of June, 1808. It would be in Catalonia, the far east of the country, on the Mediterranean, just across the border from France. Perhaps it was fitting that things would begin here. Because of its geographic location, throughout history, wars between France and Spain almost always involved fighting in Catalonia. That had essentially been true for as long as France and Spain had existed. Resistance to French invasion was deeply ingrained in the Catalan consciousness. Many in this region had been raised to instinctively think of the French as hostile invaders, and to see resistance to those invasions as part of what it meant to be Catalan. As Spain increasingly turned against the new French puppet government, many cities and towns in Catalonia declared themselves in rebellion. Troops from the Royal Spanish Army were sent to quell these rebellions, but as in many parts of Spain, these units switched sides instead. The provincial capital, Barcelona, had a large French garrison, and so it remained under the control of King Joseph's government, for the moment. But the rest of the province seemed to be slipping away. The French commander in Catalonia, General Guillaume Philibert Duhem, lacked the forces to put down all these rebellions. and with the countryside turning against the French, he also lacked any solid intelligence about what was going on outside Barcelona. Still, Napoleon ordered him to send reinforcements to Aragon and Valencia, where the situation looked even worse for other French units. Duhem ordered General François Schwartz to march a brigade of infantry about 185 miles, or 300 kilometers, west to the city of Saragossa, and to crush the rebellion in every town he passed along the way. Clearly, Duhem wanted to kill two birds with one stone, follow his orders to reinforce Aragon, and take some of the pressure off of his own position in Barcelona at the same time. General Schwartz and his brigade left Barcelona on June 4th. He had a little under 4,000 men. None were French. There was one Swiss regiment, and the rest of the column was made up of Italians. All were fresh recruits. Schwartz was flying blind. Almost the entire province had turned against the French, so he had essentially no intelligence. All he could do was follow the old crumbling Roman road to Saragossa and hope it was an uneventful journey. On the other hand, the people were eager to help the rebels. The patriots in the Catalan interior were informed almost immediately that a French column had left Barcelona, bound for Aragon. The commanders of two Spanish army units that had defected to the rebels decided this would be a perfect opportunity to strike a blow against the invaders. They found a place where the road to Aragon ran through an area of thick woods, near a town called El Bruc. It was the perfect place for an ambush. These rebel army units only numbered a few hundred men, but with the advantage of surprise and the difficult terrain, they might be able to give the French a bloody nose, then fall back before the enemy could respond. As news of this planned ambush spread among the local Catalan patriots, bands of armed militiamen began showing up at El Bruc, hoping to join in. Most of them were members of the Soma 10, which was a rural reserve police force, not unlike the French gendarmes, but they were non-professional part-timers. These Somatenes were not much better than armed peasants, but the rebel army units needed all the help they could get. The French arrived on June 6th, and the plan worked. The patriots stayed hidden until the last moment, then unleashed a deadly volley at close range. Chaos erupted among the Swiss and Italian troops, who had never been under fire before, but to their credit, it only lasted a moment. The brigade's officers rallied the men, and they formed up and charged into the forest. The patriots had never planned on making a stand. They had done what they came to do, and so they fell back as soon as they were challenged. General Schwartz did not order a pursuit, and the march continued. Imagine the elation in the Spanish ranks. They had gotten the drop on the supposedly invincible French, and finally struck a blow against the hated occupation. Not only that, they had hardly suffered any casualties. News of this skirmish spread through the Catalan countryside like wildfire. That steady stream of Somaten militiamen coming to El Bruc turned into a flood. It's not often that a force fights a battle and actually ends up with more men than they started with. Emboldened by these reinforcements and flush with victory, the Patriot commanders decided to press their luck and attack again. By now it was late in the day. The French had stopped to rest at a farm not far from El Bruc. Once again, to their credit, the French responded as they should have. As soon as they saw the rebels coming, they dropped what they were doing, and the whole brigade formed itself into a large square. As the regular troops from one of the rebel army units moved into position to engage the square, their drummer boy beat out the rhythm of the march. This sound could be heard from inside the square, and it sent a shock into General Schwartz. The fighting earlier in the day had been fleeting. None of the French officers had gotten a good look at their enemy through the heavy woods. Schwartz had been under the impression he was facing armed civilians, or perhaps militia, but improvised insurgent bands and rural militia units did not have drummer boys. That sound was proof there was at least some significant contingent of organized professional soldiers within the Spanish ranks. Regular French troops in a square would have no real issue holding off an uncoordinated, undisciplined attack by amateurs. But this was a small column, deep in hostile territory, with no possibility of relief. If they were cut off by a sizable force of Spanish regulars, they would likely be annihilated. And so, Schwartz ordered a retreat. His men fell back in good order, but found the residents of El Bruc had barricaded the road through town, so they had to detour around it. It took them a full day to get back to Barcelona, and all the way they were harassed and sniped at by the Somatenes. It must have been a terrifying experience, and many were killed or wounded. The drummer boy of El Bruc has become something of a legend in Spain. The sound of that boy's drum dealt the invaders a defeat in the first battle of Spain's War of Independence. Despite playing this pivotal role in a momentous event, historians have never been able to conclusively establish the boy's identity. When Schwartz's battered column finally arrived back in Barcelona, his commander, General Duhem, was incensed. A French brigade defeated by a motley collection of deserters and reserve policemen. This would not do. The prestige of the French army had been tarnished, and the patriots were emboldened. The ambush at El Bruc had to be answered immediately. Duhem dispatched an entire division under General Joseph Chabrol to teach the rebels a lesson. However, the Spanish would have a bigger force too. News of the victory on June 6th had inspired others to join them, more defecting regular army soldiers, more Somatenes, and members of the Miquelets, another Catalan militia organization similar to the state militias of the USA or the yeomanry of the UK. Importantly, the rebels now had four cannons. Chabrol advanced from Barcelona in four columns. They were harassed by the Catalan militia and responded with brutality, burning the town of Larbos to make an example. The French approached El Bruc on June 14th, and just like in the last engagement, the Spanish ambushed them. Chabrol's officers were determined not to make the same mistake Schwartz had a week earlier. They ordered an aggressive pursuit to chase down these rebels and defeat them. Unfortunately for the French, this is exactly what the Spanish wanted them to do. The retreating ambushers led them right into a trap, a second firing line with those four cannons. Chabrol's men suffered heavy casualties and fell back in disorder towards the main body of the division, which had just occupied the town of El Bruc itself. Chabrol began fortifying the village, and the division spent a tense night camped in El Bruc. That night, Chabrol began to feel the same misgivings that had troubled General Schwartz a week earlier. He was deep in hostile country, and faced with a determined enemy on whom he had practically no intelligence. He had no idea how many armed patriots were in the area, or how many of them were regular soldiers. The countryside was crawling with Catalan militia. If the division ran into serious trouble, what would be the chances of a messenger reaching Barcelona to ask for reinforcements? With the situation in Catalonia clearly spinning out of control, what were the chances General Duhem would be able to spare enough troops to help? Just like Schwartz a week earlier, Chabrol saw no choice but to order a retreat. Apparently, many of the Spanish patriots couldn't believe it. One volunteer, a veteran of the last war, would later recall, quote, "I had been with my battalion in all the battles of the 1793 campaign, but I was never as frightened as I was at El Bruc. The disorder of the men, one with a musket, another with a carbine, pistol, or sword, men with mattocks and sickles, and even long poles with bayonets tied at the end. What sort of force was this to hold off the French division we were facing? But the enemy fled. I don't know why." End quote. Once again, the rebels harassed the French all the way back to Barcelona. The division did make it back, but only after suffering considerable casualties.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
As the fighting broke out, there were important political developments as well. On June 9th, representatives from most of the major juntas in Spain met with members of the Council of Castile. This was roughly equivalent to the French Council of State. It was the most senior deliberative and advisory body in the country. These were the highest authorities from the old central government who were not loyal to King Joseph. They released a joint proclamation declaring the juntas the official provisional government of Spain and swearing allegiance to Ferdinand as the rightful king. The juntas now had a proper legal claim to national authority that was at least as legitimate as Joseph Bonaparte's. As we'll see in future episodes, the rule of the juntas was still very shaky, but it is quite remarkable that it had only taken a matter of weeks for a plausible alternative to the central government to emerge. Meanwhile, the whole country was sinking into violence. In Andalusia, just a day after the first skirmish at El Bruc, an improvised Patriot force tried to stop a French column advancing on the city of Córdoba, led by General Pierre Dupont. The Patriots decided to make their stand at a town called Alcolea, where the French would have to cross a bridge. The French ultimately won the day, but there was real hard fighting. They had needed artillery to dislodge the Spanish, and suffered over 100 casualties. In revenge, they sacked Córdoba for 4 days. In Aragon, the Patriots had managed to pull together an army of over 10,000 men. The French pushed them back, but they retreated to the fortified city of Saragossa. The French were unable to storm it, and were forced to prepare for a real siege. On June 12th, a Patriot force of over 4,000 men challenged another French column near the city of Valladolid. The Spanish leadership, mostly veteran officers from the Royal Army, had not wanted to fight, believing they were not yet ready to face the French in open battle. But their men were almost all fresh volunteers, full of enthusiasm, and they demanded a chance to fight. Fearing a mutiny if they refused, the Spanish commanders deployed for battle. This story is much less inspiring. The only unit of trained regulars in the entire Patriot force, a group of about 300 cavalry, broke and ran almost immediately. Seeing the veterans run, many of the volunteers joined in. The French pursued and were able to kill, wound, or capture about a quarter of them, at the cost of only a few dozen French casualties. These are just a few of about a dozen engagements that were all fought around this time. There was also a major uptick in smaller-scale violence, ambushes on French patrols, and killings of isolated stragglers and foragers. With the benefit of hindsight, it is clear that the country was descending into a strange kind of civil war, with basically the entire population and power structure on one side, and the weak, discredited central government and its foreign backers on the other. Napoleon was usually quick to adapt his thinking to changes in circumstances, but in this case, he seems not to have grasped what was going on. He was getting reports of uprisings and defections from the Spanish Royal Army, and on the activities of the juntas, but he seems to have conceptualized all this as a series of local uprisings, rather than as a nascent national movement. In these early days of the war, there was no unified, nationwide response from the French. Napoleon was dispatching columns to areas he perceived as particularly troublesome, believing a show of force would bring things under control, or as he put it, quote, "bring about the dissipation of all these troubles, raise everybody's spirits, and lead to the universal re-establishment of law and order," end quote. It wasn't until June 18th, nearly 2 weeks after the fighting had started, that the emperor would finally admit that Spain was in a state of civil war. Finally, he began shifting strategies. The French would focus on holding Madrid. Not only was this the capital, it was centrally located, quite literally, almost exactly in the middle of the country, and it was a major transportation hub and economic center. As Bonaparte put it, quote, "The object of all our efforts must be to hold Madrid. Everything is there." End quote. The situation was fluid. It was hard to predict what would come next. But whatever the next chapter of this drama held, the French would be in a much better position if they could hold on to the capital as a base of operations. To that end, Marshal Jean-Baptiste Bessières was dispatched north from Madrid to secure the lines of communication between the capital and the French border. On July 14th, Bastille Day, Bessières faced off against a Spanish force known as the Army of Galicia, led by Generals Joaquin Blake and Gregorio García de la Cuesta at the Battle of Medina del Río Seco. Bessières had an advantage enjoyed by basically no other French general in this phase of the fighting, good intelligence. There was a French mole at Spanish headquarters. Bessières knew exactly what Cuesta and Blake were planning, and he used this knowledge to divide the Spanish forces. The French also had the edge in quality of troops, leadership, and equipment. They were outnumbered nearly 2-1, but with all these advantages, the Patriots stood little chance. To their credit, many Spanish units fought hard, but it was hopeless. In the end, Bessières didn't even need to deploy his full force to achieve a shattering victory. Perhaps as many as 3,000 Spaniards were killed, wounded, or captured, at the cost of just 500 French casualties. The defeat at Medina del Río Seco was a setback for the Spanish Patriots, but it was also a bad omen for the future of this new war. The battle had been fought with a level of ferocity and brutality that hadn't been present in the past few campaigns we've discussed. There was real hatred here on both sides. After the battle, a French general reported, quote, "Our men did not want to take any prisoners. They said, 'These men are brigands. They kill us when we march alone.'" End quote. The war in Spain was shaping up to be a particularly ugly one. Grisly as it may have been, in the wake of this victory, Bessières was able to reoccupy much of northern Spain. The lines of communication between Madrid and France were now more or less secure, at least for the moment. Next, the French would turn their attention south. Central Spain is divided from southern Spain by a mountain range, the Sierra Morena. By this point, the south was the part of the country where the Patriots were the strongest. Napoleon wanted to maintain a foothold on the far side of the mountains. Otherwise, any future expeditions to the south would have to force their way over the Sierra Morena, where it would be very easy for the Patriots to hold them off in the narrow passes. Fortunately for Bonaparte, there was already a large French column south of the Sierra Morena, a force under General Pierre Dupont. As I mentioned earlier in the episode, Dupont had fought one of the first engagements of the war, crossing the bridge at Alcolea, then sacking Cordoba. Patriot forces in Andalusia grew stronger by the day, and soon Dupont was forced to retreat. However, he stayed on the far side of the Sierra Morena. Dupont was too outnumbered to continue the advance, but not outnumbered enough to retreat all the way back to Madrid, and so he simply stayed put for several weeks, his forces not doing much of anything while fighting raged across the country. Now that French strategic focus was shifting south, Dupont and his men would come back into play. Reinforcements arrived from Madrid, bringing their number up to about 23,000. Dupont's orders were to march southwest and pacify the rebel-held cities of Cordoba and Seville before proceeding to Cadiz on the Atlantic, where they were to rescue a French naval squadron trapped in the harbor. These were the survivors of Trafalgar, still anchored in the same port they had retreated to after the battle. It was an ambitious plan. Dupont and his men would be expected to traverse about 300 kilometers, or 186 miles, of hostile country much of it poor and sparsely populated. There would be little food to forage, and their supply lines would stretch all the way back over the mountains to Madrid. Their patrols and supply convoys would have to brave Patriot partisans and bandits. And, on top of that, there was a Patriot army of unknown size operating in the area, led by General Francisco Castaños. Castaños had spent nearly his entire life in the Spanish Royal Army. Quite literally, he was 50 years old and had been commissioned as an officer cadet at the tender age of 10. However, despite his 40 years of service, he had never taken independent command in combat. Napoleon considered this operation to be of vital importance, and he was confident of success. As he put it, quote, "Under the present conditions, General Dupont is the most important of all. If the enemy succeeds in holding the defiles of the Sierra Morena, it will be difficult to chase him out of them. If Marshal Bessieres has been able to defeat the Army of Galicia with a few casualties and small effort, less than 8,000 troops being engaged, there can be no doubt that with 20,000 men, General Dupont will be able to overthrow everybody he meets." End quote. However, the forces faced by Dupont would be much more formidable than the Army of Galicia. Unlike basically every other Patriot army in Spain, Castaños' men were mostly trained regulars, including some of the best regiments of the Royal Army. The fresh volunteers under his command were untested, but unlike their hapless comrades in the north, they had at least been able to train during that month-long lull in the fighting in this part of the country. In the north, Bessieres had several units of the Imperial Guard under his command. Dupont had only a single veteran unit. It was quite a good one, the Marines of the Imperial Guard. However, the rest of his troops were all raw recruits, and many were foreign. The two forces were actually roughly equivalent in quality. Dupont's column got moving in late June and found it was slow going. Unable to forage, they had to travel with a huge, ponderous supply train. According to some sources, this supply train also included a large amount of loot taken during the sack of Cordoba a month earlier. It was unseasonably warm, even by the standards of southern Spain in summer. The men sometimes struggled to find enough water. Perhaps unsurprisingly in these conditions, hundreds of French soldiers fell sick. Leaving them behind or sending them back to Madrid would mean almost certain death at the hands of the Patriot partisans, and so they too went into the supply train. Dupont's force was moving at a crawl. General Castaños now had over 30,000 men under his command, with more arriving every day. Dupont's offensive had barely begun, but already it was starting to look doomed. Mercifully, new orders arrived from Madrid. Dupont was to pause the offensive, fall back the way he came, and await reinforcements. However, Dupont did not do so. Different sources provide different explanations here. He may have simply disobeyed, or his orders may have been unclear or conflicting. In any case, he would pause the offensive, but the column would stay in place. By this point, his troops had finally reached the Guadalquivir River. Not only was this a natural defensive position, it was a source of water, and there were major settlements nearby. Stopping on the banks of the river must have been a much more attractive proposition than staggering back over that scorched, barren plain. General Castaños saw an opportunity. The French were outnumbered and sluggish, with a tenuous supply line, and no hope of reinforcement. He had good intelligence and knew Dupont's men were suffering and not in top form. With every day, their suffering grew worse. Almost all the local peasants had either fled or taken up arms. In order to feed themselves, the French were forced to harvest and mill grain themselves. Water was plentiful, but they soon discovered it was of poor quality, leading to many more falling sick. They were constantly harassed by bandits and partisans. A French army doctor would later recall, quote, "The situation was terrible. Every night we heard armed peasants prowling around us, lured as they were by the hope of plunder, and every night we expected to be murdered, end quote. With DuPont's force in dire straits, Castaños made his move. The Spanish attacked the French positions all along the Guadalquivir River. DuPont's men were able to hold them off, but due to a miscommunication, one of DuPont's subordinates, General Dominique Vidal, abandoned his position after the fighting. This allowed some of the best Patriot units to easily cross the river. These were mostly Swiss troops. Much like the old French Royal Army, the Spanish Army had a large number of foreign contingents. These Swiss regiments had a good reputation and were led by a capable commander, General Theodore von Reding. The French were now in a dangerous position. DuPont's left flank was now falling back, while the general himself and the main body of his force remained in place along the river. Reding and his troops were over the river and pushing north, where they might soon threaten DuPont's lines of communication. There was some hard fighting. A French divisional commander, General Dominique Gobert, was killed. Reding was checked, but retained his bridgehead over the river. We've talked many times in this episode about the Patriots' huge advantage in intelligence. Now it would come into play again, with massive consequences. At this critical moment, General Vidal, commander of the French left flank, was fed a piece of misinformation. He was informed that Spanish forces had seized the town of La Carolina, miles north of the French position, right on the main road to Madrid. If this had been true, it would have meant the entire French column was cut off. They would have to immediately focus all their efforts on retaking La Carolina and reopening the road, or risk imminent destruction. General Vidal swallowed this lie. He informed DuPont, and DuPont agreed that Vidal should take his entire command north as soon as possible to seize La Carolina. In the meantime, DuPont and the rest of the column would disengage from the Spanish and march to join Vidal as soon as possible. Vidal set off immediately, but DuPont moved more slowly, waiting hours before ordering the retreat, and then hampered by that massive baggage train with so many sick soldiers. A huge, dangerous gulf developed between Vidal and the main body of the column. This gap was almost exactly due north of the Spanish bridgehead over the river. DuPont had made a terrible mistake by allowing his units to become so separated. Castaños and the Patriots would make him pay for it. While DuPont dithered, the Patriots seized and began to fortify a town called Bailén, which stood directly between DuPont and Vidal, right on the road between the two positions. That piece of disinformation, that the French had been cut off at La Carolina, had produced a panicked reaction at French headquarters. That panicked reaction had led to most of the force actually being cut off at Bailén. If the French could not take this town, the main body of the column was in imminent danger of being surrounded. General Vidal had no idea. He was still leading his men in a desperate forced march towards La Carolina, getting further and further from the actual crucial position at Bailén. General Reding arranged his troops in a double line in the hills outside Bailén. DuPont had Reding right in front of him, and Castaños advancing on his rear with the rest of the Spanish army. The French would have to break through this position at Bailén very quickly if they hoped to avoid disaster. They were sick, hungry, thirsty, exhausted, and outnumbered. The enemy had good positions on high ground. As soon as they saw those Spanish units outside Bailén, DuPont and his officers instantly grasped the seriousness of their situation. They had to take that town now, before Castaños could arrive to surround them. Despite their miserable condition and almost total inexperience, the French troops fought with discipline and intensity. Given the geography, they had no choice but to make frontal assaults uphill in full view of the enemy, but they did what was asked of them, without hesitation. Their commander did not perform quite so well. Rather than gathering all his units for a big decisive push, DuPont threw his men into battle piecemeal. For hours, the French attacked again and again in small, uncoordinated assaults. Amazingly, they succeeded in penetrating the Spanish line on several occasions, but each time they were held off by the second line or thrown back by a counterattack. The day was hellishly hot, probably in the 40s Celsius or over 100 Fahrenheit. The French had no good sources of water, and thirst was starting to become an issue. Barrels of their cannons overheated, and the crews had no water with which to cool them down. Dupont had hoped he would be joined by General Vidal, attacking by land from the opposite direction, but by this point, Vidal and his men were much too far away to hear the sound of guns. Messengers from Dupont did eventually reach them, and they dutifully turned around and began another forced march, back the way they came. But by this point, they had been walking for nearly 3 days straight. They were exhausted, overheated, and low on supplies. They had a long way to go, and were not making good time. Meanwhile, the fighting around Bailen raged on, and the condition of Dupont's troops continued to deteriorate. Strangely, many of the combatants on both sides were Swiss. The old Swiss regiments of the Spanish Royal Army had been divided. Some had chosen to fight for Napoleon, others remained true to their adopted country. Now they found themselves facing one another on the battlefield. As the situation began to look increasingly desperate for the French, two of Dupont's Swiss regiments had second thoughts about dying for the emperor. They defected en masse, joining their compatriots on the Spanish side. It was a terrible blow for the French. They had just lost a significant portion of their force in a single stroke. There was still no sign of General Vidal. At long last, Dupont marshaled all his remaining forces for a large, coordinated attack. He had one elite unit, the Marines of the Imperial Guard. They would form the spearhead, and Dupont himself would lead the charge. Time was running out. This attack had to succeed, victory or death. The fighting was intense. The Marines of the Guard fought almost to the last man. General Dupont was shot through the abdomen and had to be carried to the rear, although he would survive. It was a valiant effort, but by now there were too few French troops to overcome this strong position. They were forced to fall back to their starting points. At almost the same time, the advance units of Castaños' force began to appear in Dupont's rear. He was surrounded. The French had shown incredible toughness, remaining steadfast in horrible conditions, but the realization that their breakout had failed seems to have finally broken many within the French ranks, including some officers. The wounded Dupont was among them. He began talking about surrender. Some of his subordinates had not lost hope. They begged him to reconsider. No one knew how far away Vidal was. If they could just hold out a little longer, there was still the chance of rescue. Dupont overruled them. He sent a messenger to the Spanish lines, asking for a temporary ceasefire so they could begin negotiations for a surrender. The Spanish agreed. Meanwhile, Vidal was still on the march towards Bailen. His advance guard began to encounter Spanish units. Some of their officers approached under a flag of truce to inform Vidal that his commander had negotiated a ceasefire and would soon be surrendering. Clearly, they hoped Vidal would feel bound by this agreement. But the French commander responded, quote, "Tell your general that I care nothing about that, and that I am going to attack him," end quote. He did so, and his forces performed brilliantly, completely shattering several Spanish regiments. However, Vidal had no idea what was ahead of him. By now, he should have been close enough to Bailen to hear the sound of artillery fire, but there was only ominous silence. Either those Spanish officers had been telling the truth, or Dupont's force had already been destroyed. Under the circumstances, Vidal decided he couldn't risk pressing on. He called a halt and ordered his men to fall back. Back at Bailen, Dupont dragged on the surrender negotiations for several days, probably hoping for a rescue. It never came. Meanwhile, General Vidal still did not consider himself bound by the negotiations. The Spanish very much disagreed. Dupont was Vidal's direct superior. The way they saw it, the whole French column had been defeated, not only Dupont's force. But Vidal was not surrounded. He still had relatively clear lines of communication to Madrid. His troops had been victorious in their last engagement with the Spanish. Finally, the Patriots threatened to massacre all of Dupont's men unless Vidal surrendered too. With the way the war had gone so far, Vidal had every reason to believe they were serious. He complied. On July 23, 1808, Dupont agreed to meet with General Castaños outside Bailén to formally offer his surrender. In keeping with long-standing European military tradition, he offered Castaños his sword, saying, quote, "You may well be proud of this day, General. It is remarkable because I have never lost a pitched battle until now. I, who have been in more than 20." End quote. Castaños replied, quote, "It is all the more remarkable because I was never in one before in my life." End quote. Although it's a great line, from what I can tell, it is not actually true. Castaños had seen combat against the French during the War of the First Coalition. Maybe he meant this was his first time actually leading an army in independent command. Or maybe he just wanted to humiliate the pompous enemy general. French had suffered setbacks in the early weeks of the war, but nothing even approaching the scale of the disaster at Bailén. Dupont had lost over 20,000 men in the space of a few weeks. One out of every five French soldiers in Spain had been killed or captured in this campaign. The Patriots only lost about 1,000 men. The Spanish triumph at Bailén ensured that Andalusia would remain free of French troops for the foreseeable future. Just as Napoleon had feared, they would now be able to take control of the passes over the Sierra Morena. Patriot control over southern Spain was now more or less secure. The juntas now had a large base of operations from which to continue building their movement. The future of Spanish resistance was assured, at least for now. News of this victory would reverberate all across Spain and far beyond. For the first time in nearly a decade, France had suffered a major defeat on the battlefield. Napoleon may have been a master of spin, but not even he could deny that Bailén was a catastrophe. Next episode, we'll discuss the fallout of this momentous battle. Until then, thanks for listening.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, this is Matt from the Explorers Podcast. I want to invite you to join me on the voyages and journeys of the most famous explorers in the history of the world. These are the thrilling and captivating stories of Magellan, Shackleton, Lewis and Clark, and so many other famous and not so famous adventurers from throughout history. Go to explorerspodcast.com or just look us up on your podcast app. That's the Explorers Podcast.